You're listening to Decolonize Social Work, a conversation about social work, oppression, and liberation. I'm your co-host, Ondine.
And I'm your co-host, Drew.
Hello, hello. For episode 5, we are bringing you something slightly different. This is our first episode where we have a guest. We're really excited. Our friend CT has over 20 years of experience in child welfare, and we just have a phenomenal conversation with them. But because it's our first time interviewing someone else, the audio quality isn't quite what we're used to bringing to you all, but the conversation still is fantastic. So if you have the ability to use headphones to listen to this, it might help it seem a little bit more clear. We'll promise to have our transcript live on our website too in the next couple of days, and we really hope that you enjoy. Lastly, this is a two-parter, so after you listen to this first segment, we really hope you go on to the next one so that you can hear how our conversation concludes. All right, enjoy.
Well, welcome everybody. This is the 5th episode.
Number 5
of the Decolonized Social Work Podcast, and we're very excited about the topic today. We're going to be talking about Child Protective Services in the Department for Community-Based Services, and we think that this is worth talking about because so many social workers in the United States end up working at some point in their career with child protection. Also, popularly, people, when they think of social workers, they think of taking people's kids away.
I talked about that in the first episode, that like when I was becoming a social worker, my impression was that most social workers did work with kids, and then I actually, you know, learned what it's a lot more expansive than that.
So yeah.
I'm one of those people.
Yeah. However, Drew and I have not worked for Child Protective Services. And so while we have opinions, because that's who we are, and we have research abilities, we needed to talk to somebody who's actually been in the system. So our guest here today, CT, used to work for Child Protective Services for how long?
Oh my gosh. I started in 1994. Hmm. I was 22 years old.
So wow. Kind of right out of undergrad?
Right out of undergrad. 22 years old, and then sort of stopped officially working in child welfare in 2012.
Okay.
But still, CPS is like the mob. Like, they never, like, you can't ever really get out of it.
Gotcha.
So I still get some calls to come in and do consultations on occasion. Usually it's more training-related kinds of stuff. But I just feel like once you've been in that system and you've done mm-hmm. that work, like you're always a part of that system
mm-hmm.
for good, bad, or whatever that really means. And so I have seen child welfare in this state from pretty much every angle, with the exception of actually being served by the system. So I know it well.
I'm really excited to learn from you. And just also kind of to frame our conversation up, as y'all know, this podcast is about decolonizing social mm-hmm. work. So we're especially approaching this conversation from that perspective. So is the Department of Child Protective Services or the institution of CPS inherently a colonialist framework? You know, is it a white supremacist
and in what
machine?
Ways, yeah, in what ways are social workers complicit in holding up that system mm-hmm. as well, which is another thing that we try to include in all the topics that we talk about here.
Yeah. So here's one thing that I do want to say. For all of the problems, and there are a host of problems in child welfare, it was where I learned the most mm. about what it really means to be a social worker and what mm. that work is really, really supposed to be. Not what people do, but what it is supposed to be. That's where I learned advocacy skills. That is where I learned that the position that I'm in allowed me access to people in power.
Yeah.
And so because I had that access, that helped me find my voice around social and racial justice issues.
Mm-hmm.
And it also helped me understand how systems show up in people's lives and not just like how we read about it, but I can see it happening. So it was the best training ground and the best educational sort of work for me personally, but I'm absolutely a critic.
Yeah.
And I think all people should be a critic of this system. And I think if the general public really knew mm-hmm. how this functioned,
mm-hmm.
they would be like, burn this shit to the damn like, just stop it. But, you know, when you get to control other people's narratives and child welfare controls other people's narratives,
yeah.
you can make it seem like whatever you need it to seem like. But it's a dangerous system for anybody.
Yeah.
Not just the families that find themselves in it, but it's not safe for the workers either.
I've heard that.
It is a bad place. It's a bad place to work.
Yeah. And, you know, I know there are going to be people listening who are either currently working for child welfare who may or may not have the same opinion. So I just want to, acknowledge that.
Yeah, like some people love this work. And I think at certain points in my career, I loved it too.
Mm-hmm.
But I also knew that I was working in such a shitty system. And I knew that some of the things that I was doing was complicit in the destruction of entire families. Like, I knew that.
Yeah.
And I've had, over my lifetime, had to sort of reconcile my role.
Mm-hmm.
Because workers are complicit in all of this. Like, it's your job.
Yeah.
And so I think back to some families that I worked with really early in my career and just how super judgmental I was.
Mm.
There was one woman, I will never forget this, because I was such an ass. I really, really was. And I used to teach in a college of social work, and I would tell my students this story. And there was this woman, just a very, pretty basic sort of referral, like nobody was getting removed or anything like that.
Okay.
And I went to her house, and she lived in a housing project. And I remember the weekend before I saw this lady, I'd gone to Value City Furniture.
Oh, my.
Yes, because I had a job. Now, keep in mind, I only made $16,404.
Wow.
Before taxes.
This is at the cabinet?
This is, yes, in 1994, $16,404. I will never forget that number. Because I was like,
really?
I'm rich.
Oh, man.
I got insurance and everything. This is great. And so I remember I had gone to Value City and looked at this living room set.
Mm-hmm.
And it was gorgeous. Tanky shit.
Oh, I'm sure. I can imagine it had like some kind of 90s.
Indeed. And that some sort of animal print, I think, was in there as well. And a lot of black and gold. It was a lot. At the time, it was really dope. And so I look at it, and I'm like talking to the person. I'm like, oh, I cannot afford any of this. Like, this is way out of my budget.
Was that before they had layaway?
Oh, I would have still been paying on that thing when I got it. Like, just... Yeah, and layaway wasn't even an option. I'm like, who's got money for layaway? Every week? No. And so I go to this woman's house, and I'm like, all right, she lives in the projects. And so I already expect a certain kind of family.
Right.
Because that's what you're told when you get into this system. Like, all these families are trash, and this is where people live, and people are just dirty, and all of that.
That was part of, like, your orientation to the culture of that job.
The way workers talked to me about families when I first started, I was just like, oh my God, like, y'all hate everybody. Mm-hmm. And so I go into this woman's house, and she opens the door, and goddamn it, y'all, she didn't have the entire living room set that I had just looked at.
Wow.
Lamps, picture frames, the rug, she had it all.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember in that moment, the way that I saw her and her whole situation, I don't even remember what she was even saying. I was so caught up with the fact that, like, you, someone who lives in the projects, has the entire living room suit that I, college-educated state worker, just looked at and can't afford. And I distinctly remember, like, the way that I talked to her, and the way that I even looked at her, the way that I looked around her house, was so judgmental. It was, like, it was such trash behavior on my part. It really, really, really was. Because I was really operating from this place like, you don't even deserve this.
No, not affording any dignity or worth to
not, that's not what you're encouraged to do.
It seems kind of dehumanizing to the people that you are told to go check on or investigate.
It absolutely is. I distinctly remember being in training and then teaching us ways to, like, not sit on dirty furniture. And when I look back at that now, I'm just like, you really have to be taught us that?
Mm-hmm.
And I still remember the move. Like, you have your little blue binder, because all state workers at the time have these little stupid blue binders. And you're like, okay, y'all sit. And then you just sort of slide that up.
You sit on your binder.
And you sit on your binder, and you sit at the very, very, like, you scoot up, and you sit at the very, very edge of the seat.
People pick up on that stuff.
They absolutely
do. Yeah, people aren't stupid.
Mm-hmm. They absolutely do. They absolutely do. And in hindsight, like, I remember all the times that I did. And at the time, I was really operating from this place of, like, these people are dirty.
Yeah.
and I don't want to be around dirty people.
Mm-hmm.
We used to get neglect referrals on, like, unclean homes.
Okay, which is, I'm sure that's a spectrum, right?
It is such a spectrum.
I feel like I have an unclean home at the moment.
Listen, if somebody walks across my carpet, they're like, is it like corn everywhere? What is this? What am I stepping on? It's really like little pieces of the dog treats, but you know. But still, they would be like, oh, this is gross. And the way that we were trained, we used to call those referrals dirt referrals.
Wow.
Like literal dirt referrals.
That reminds us of what we were talking about in our last episode around just the culture of workers calling clients things like frequent flyers,
mm-hmm.
right? Just
this idea that, like, you should have perfect clients and otherwise, like, they're either judged for needing the services that you're actually offering
mm-hmm.
or just shaming people
mm-hmm.
for these problems that, in a lot of ways, weren't their fault in the first place.
So many of these families, it is literally not their fault.
Yeah.
It is society's fault, and it is the systems that we're all dependent upon
yeah.
that have completely failed them. Completely failed them.
Yeah.
And then you get... The vast majority of workers, when they first start, are really, really young.
So, again, I remember they were recruiting us in graduate school,
mm-hmm.
but it wasn't even grad students. They were looking at undergrad social work students and kind of enticing them.
Like you said, you were, 22?
22 years old. I had no business making decisions that will impact a kid's life for the rest of their life. And not just them, but their kids and their kids and their kids. But at 22... You don't have the cognitive reasoning
mm-hmm.
to really understand, like, what it is that you're really doing. Like, they lie to you. They absolutely lie to you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I first started, I started on a Wednesday. I will never forget this. I started on a Wednesday, and they were like, here's these policy manuals. And I'm telling you, they were, like, five of the biggest, thickest manuals of things I've ever seen.
I'm sure because it's government, right?
Oh, my God, yeah. So there's, like, 75 pages for every, like, one thing.
Right.
And so I'm just sitting there like, okay. And so I start reading these things. They don't make any sense. No
legalese.
Sense, no sense at all. Made no sense. And so I'm just like,
right.
On Monday, I walked back into my office. There were 15 cases sitting on my desk.
Oh my God.
So they expected you to just sit with this
mm-hmm.
massive amount of information,
mm-hmm.
somehow digest it
mm-hmm.
appropriately, that you would be able to just get to work.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
and then start applying it
mm-hmm.
immediately.
So there was no period of, say, shadowing.
It was a period of me going on home visits with workers whose cases I was getting.
So they were transferring them.
Happily, like.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah.
And of course, I'm the new kid, so I'm getting like everybody's worst case.
Yeah.
And my 15 cases, and I remember I walked out of my office and I said, somebody left their bunch of stuff on my desk. And everybody in the office was like, what are you
like, 1, 2, 3, that it?
Those are your cases. And I was like, what do you mean?
Mm.
Wow.
And then my supervisor at the time was like, well, you know, you'll go out with the worker and they'll introduce you to the family. And then you can read the running records and the file to kind of catch up on what's going on. And I'm just like.
And this is the training you're getting in order to be able to make really big decisions. That, like you said, will impact
mm-hmm.
these kids and their families.
I think it's training for like 6 months, like official training for like 6 months.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now they've done substantially better job with that, but like even the training, that's a whole nother subject. It's a whole nother thing. But 6 months of just winging it and really having no idea and just really flying from the seat of my pants about stuff and really listening to other workers who've been there for a while. Some of which were good, some of which were absolute trash.
Yeah.
And so then my practice was absolute trash at points because
mm-hmm.
that's who I'm learning from.
Right.
And it just, I was so young, I didn't even realize what I was doing. And when I say I didn't realize what I was, I had no clue what I was doing. I had no idea why I was doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And it always felt icky.
So it sounds like there was a lack of context to it.
Yeah.
And when we were getting ready to do this podcast with you, again, because we haven't worked for CVS.
Mm-hmm.
We did a little bit of research to like learn what we could about the origins, right,
mm-hmm.
of this system.
Mm-hmm.
And in the United States, it looks like officially Child Protective Services wasn't under the auspices of like the government until about the 70s.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Prior to that, there were some governments, state governments, who offered these services, but a lot of like charitable organizations and
mm-hmm.
like private organizations.
Mm-hmm.
And then I mean, you found some interesting information about the origin.
Yeah, actually, there are two writers from City University of New York, Amy Mulzer and Tara Erz, in a journal article called However Kindly Intentioned, Structural Racism and Volunteer CASA Programs. Mm-hmm. They actually argue that some of the practices that came to be known as child protective services really started right after the Civil War, when middle-class white women over the age of 30 played the primary role in establishing the modern child welfare system, the ability of white women to speak for the best interests of poor children of color, to advocate for their removal from their families, and to receive deference and praise from legal systems, comes to our modern legal system with deep roots. Mm-hmm. So it really kind of starts here, but even goes back further than that, like this idea of family intervention being acted out as removal of children from families too, right?
Yeah. I mean, many of us who are Americans who live in the United States know of our ugly history of removing indigenous children from their families. And actually, there's a great article in Teen Vogue, which I love Teen Vogue.
I mean, Teen Vogue,
they are just amazing.
They are.
This is a fairly recent, so we will link it to our website, but this article talks a bit about how the foster system is really harming indigenous children in the United States, and that in the 1800s, Captain Richard Henry Pratt said, "Kill the Indian, save the man." And this was the mantra of the organization of the federal government at the time, that we will remove these kids from their families and assimilate them into white American culture, teach them Christianity, have them speak English, cut their hair, all of this, so that we will eventually, over time, eradicate indigenous people in their history. And the other article goes on to talk about how these practices continue to happen. And we can talk more about that later. But we have a long history in our country. You wrote a really interesting book about a year or two ago, right, about, like, even in Hawaii.
Yeah, I think it was actually Sarah Bowles' book, which talks about the history of basically colonization of Polynesian islands and how it was really Mormons there who put themselves in charge of removing indigenous families to live with white people, to basically acculturate them or civilize them in a way. And I was actually going to refer back to this article I just read from. I think one of the questions is, like, who sets the standard, right? We've talked about that in some other episodes as well. And who decides what is good parenting? What is responsible parenting? And going back to the middle-class white women after the Civil War, the authors of this article say notions of pure, good white motherhood were used to set the bar for what was deemed safe and appropriate parenting, informed the basis for an expansion of the intrusion into the private family life of those whose parenthood did not conform to that ideal. And I think that's...
I mean, this is what we talk about in every episode of our podcast.
I mean, like, who establishes norms? Who has the power to establish those norms? I mean, very clearly, like, this is what is used to assess families of other cultures and determine you're not fit.
This is deep-rooted stuff. And I'm curious, so tell me, how does that continue to look? Does that still show up?
Oh, my gosh. It absolutely shows up. I think it is, it's the foundation of child welfare itself. This is the standard of parenting that is white, Christian, two parent, preferably
heterosexual.
Absolutely heterosexual.
Yeah.
Like, there's gay people?
Oh, never mind. I'm sorry.
Two parent, heterosexual, everybody's cis, everybody's Christian. Mom doesn't work because her job is to raise the kids.
Of course.
And dad's job is to do everything else. And so I 100% have seen that play out so much in child welfare. And it's really, really interesting. So I went back and was just looking, reminiscing on the website. And I saw the civil rights brochure that they have for parents. And one of the first things that I noticed was that, like, there's this lukewarm non-discrimination policy that is non-discrimination based on political belief. That's the first one, which I find fascinating. Race, color, national origin, religion, age, mental or physical disability, or sex. Which means everything else, we can get y'all.
We can
absolutely get y'all. And so I've seen people be penalized for working two jobs because they have to work two jobs. Case plans, to me, are little pieces of paper that are full of penalties for folks.
Yeah.
They're absolutely full of penalties for folks. And so a case plan could look like getting a parenting assessment. Okay, so what does that mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because what's the standard for parenting? And we know what that is. Mm-hmm. Mental health assessments. I don't have mental health issues. But the assumption is that anyone who comes in contact with the cabinet automatically has mental health issues. You definitely will after.
Yeah.
You will absolutely have it after. Let's see, parenting classes, if there's a hint of any sort of substance use,
yeah,
then you have to have a substance abuse assessment. Toward the end of my time working, I was starting to see things like a psychological exam.
How is that different than a mental health assessment?
About $1,500.
So that's on the burden of the parent to pay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And so I never knew a case where somebody was able to get a psychological exam completed. And so if you don't complete the task on your case plan, then you're non-compliant. And you're non-compliant long enough, we can terminate your parental rights. And that can happen real quick.
So I've heard some, I think, pretty valid critique of case plans
mm-hmm.
being pretty coercive.
Mm-hmm.
And parents not even understanding. Like, I've heard examples, for instance, so let me know if this is true, of parents being told that they had to sign off and agree to a case plan. Otherwise, they're going to put their kids in foster care.
Mm-hmm.
But the parent doesn't know that to actually put their kid in foster care, the system might actually have to go before a judge,
mm-hmm.
and there's some steps.
Mm-hmm.
If the parent knew that, they
mm-hmm.
might be able to decide, actually,
mm-hmm.
I'm not signing this right
mm-hmm.
now.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, did you see that?
I saw that a lot. So the last probably 8 years that I worked in the system, my job was to facilitate family team meetings. And so I was the person in the room who would facilitate the development of case plans. And so the family would be there, the cabinet folks would be there, sometimes attorneys would show. Very rarely did family show up without like other supportive people. And there would be some times where we would start out talking about what this family does well. And I can't tell you how many times like an investigator would say, well, I don't have any concerns about their parenting. Perfect. Great.
So where are we
here?
There's that. Then we get to the case plan, first thing, parenting assessment. And so this would be me.
Help me to understand.
This is what I would say to workers. So help this family understand why. On the strength side, you said there's no concerns with the parent. And you as the investigator, like, you said that, right?
Right.
I don't have any concerns.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So help them understand, because it's their case plan, why there's a parenting assessment on here if there's no concerns with their parenting. Seems a little odd to me. And then the families will be like, yeah. Like, yeah, why? And then a lot of times workers will be like, all right, well, we can take that off.
But if you hadn't been there to facilitate that conversation and to point out what was
mm-hmm.
actually going on.
Mm-hmm.
This really reminds me of the way that police will pick up young folks, you
mm-hmm.
know, typically brown and black
mm-hmm.
people, and basically arrest them for, like, ridiculous stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then some prosecutor will coerce them to take a plea bargain
mm-hmm.
when really they probably could have gone in front
mm-hmm.
of a judge, gotten it dismissed. But
mm-hmm.
the thing about the plea bargain is like, well, you can get back out, you can pay your bail and all this stuff. And
yeah.
basically what it does is create a system where people have convictions on their record of things that they weren't even guilty for,
right.
only because they were holding their freedom hostage, basically.
It's the same thing they're holding
yeah.
those kids hostage.
Yeah.
They really, really are. And so there were so many of those cases, and probably the time that my unit was doing, and we probably did almost 4,000 of those. And so that's 4,000 opportunities to see how this system really works or does not work.
Mm-hmm.
And there were times where, you know, I probably overstepped my bounds as a facilitator, but I felt okay doing that. Because
we talk about what social workers have a responsibility
yeah.
to do.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so there would be these moments where I'm just like, I don't think this actually needs to be on this case plan. And sometimes workers would push back, and I would be like, well, then help, like, give us a really good reason why this needs to be on this case plan. And there were a couple times where I would tell them, like, you don't have to sign it.
Mm.
You don't have to. Now, if you don't sign it, these are all the things that they are going to do, but you don't have to sign it. You can talk to an attorney.
Mm.
But it was always this, workers coming back, well, if you don't sign this case plan, then when the next time we go to court, mm-hmm. that's the language. The next time we go to court, then we'll just tell the judge that you didn't want to sign this case for me. And then you are presented as non-compliant mm-hmm. from the get-go. Mm-hmm. And then judges will be like, okay, so like you don't want your kids. Right. All you got to do is do this stuff. And of course, family's going to be like, fine, I will sign you.
Of course.
What other option do they have at that point?
They don't have an option. They don't have
it
an option.
It sounds like so much of this is really subjective. I know that you had filed
the whole system is subjective.
Like there's like a definition, right?
Yeah, of what is considered child abuse and neglect. It's like, I guess, the working federal definition mm-hmm. from the Department of Health and Human Services from a 2012 report. And this is the general definition that some states can build upon, but this is the basic working of it, which says any recent act or failure to act on the part of a parent or caretaker which results in death, serious physical or emotional harm, sexual abuse or exploitation, or an act or failure to act which presents an imminent risk of serious harm. It's that last part to me, like, what is harm?
What is
serious harm? Yeah. Like, is what I think is unsafe what everybody should think is unsafe?
So, when I was early in my career, one of my coworkers wanted to file a petition on a family, and it was like a mom and maybe four or five little kids. I just remember the kids were all under the age of five. Mm-hmm. And I was like, ooh, what's going on? And she said, well, they're all sleeping in one bed. And I was like, okay.
And
she was like, they should all have separate beds. I was like, girl, are you serious right now? I was like, so you're about to completely dismantle an entire family because people don't have beds? Mm-hmm. Well, they should all, like, kids should have their own beds and they should, you know, they shouldn't have to sleep four or five kids in a bed. I was like, is the bed filthy? Like, is there something wrong with the bed that right. they're in? No. Is it a twin bed? Like, what?
Right.
No. And it was a freaking queen size bed.
I mean, again, this reminds me of like who establishes the norms right. about what's acceptable.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, and beds like look very different based on culture. And I distinctly remember a time when I pulled my entire bed off, like a mattress, and just had a mattress on the floor because in my little 13-year-old head, I was like, this is how people sleep in New York in lofts. And so my mom came in my room and was like, what in the hell is going on in here? And I was like, listen, it's my room.
Right.
Now, somebody could have come in and been like,
look at this child sleeping on the floor.
And I would have been removed. And I'm telling you, it is so easy to get a kid removed if you know the language.
So say a little bit more about that. What is the language?
The language, risk of harm, failure to protect, like if mom has, or even dad, but if mom has a significant other who has any sort of a criminal record, like a possession of marijuana charge, I could write that up as mom is exposing child to substance abuse.
Wow.
Whether that is the fact or not, but like that's how I could write that up. And I look back at the times where I've written petitions, and I'm like, damn, shit, I could get, like, literally anybody's kid removed based off of just knowing what the language is. It's very, there's, like, trigger words.
Mm-hmm.
And failure to protect is, like, one of the biggest ones.
Like, I could imagine if a parent, like, if I'm a parent and I have a kid and I don't put their seatbelt on, somebody mm-hmm. could probably call and be like, oh, he failed to protect mm-hmm. that kid from an accident. Mm-hmm. It could potentially happen. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
That's terrifying.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's funny that you mentioned that because I distinctly remember, again, really young in my career, where a visit had just happened. We, you know, put the kid in the parent's car or whatever, whoever it was. And then, like, they didn't have a car seat. And we were just like, oh my God, somebody called the police. They don't have a car seat. And somebody called the police and gave them a description of the car and a license plate. And I'm just like, and it, like, in that moment, it made sense because I was operating. I thought that's what you were supposed to do. But in hindsight, I'm like, what we should have done is been like, hey, do you have a car seat?
Here's how you can get one.
Here's how you can get one.
So that's actually, I want to go back to something you said with the example of the caseworker, the social worker, and the people sleeping in the mm-hmm. bed. Like, it seems like it went from discovery of the children sleeping in the bed to writing this up as a report. Where mm-hmm. was the intervention to prevent that from escalating, to be like, hey, they might need some services, they might need some assistance, let's find them some stuff to kind of prevent me from having to make this decision.
That's not what child welfare does.
So it sounds like it's all reactive.
It's very reactive. At all.
It's very, very reactive. It is incredibly reactive. Now, what should have happened in a situation like that was that, first of all, you should have left them alone.
Right. There's no problem.
Yeah, there's not an issue.
Like, y'all cool? Yeah, y'all cool, bye. Mm-hmm. And just leave it alone. But if somebody was so concerned about that, the first thing that you should have done was try to figure out how to maybe get an extra bed.
Right.
If you were so concerned about it. But it went from first home visit, they're all sleeping in the same bed, to all these kids are at risk. Like, they're going to die if they're all sleeping in the same bed. Mm-hmm. And what I remember about being a little bitty kid, I feel like they just fall asleep wherever.
They sleep through anything.
Yeah. Yeah, and so I'm like, yeah, they can all be on the couch. Who cares? Like, they're safe.
Right.
That was really the primary issue that she had with that case. Now, I remember our supervisor was like, no, listen, we can't do that. Mm-hmm. And so in that moment, the supervisor had, you know, some clarity and some sense. But that worker was adamant that they should come out of the house. And I'm just like, that's...
Tell me a little bit from your experience how Black and brown children in particular, and Black and brown families are impacted by the system.
This is one of the worst systems to ever show up in the life cycle of a Black or brown family, Black families in particular, because they're much more likely to have their kids removed. One of the things that I used to work on was racial disproportionality. And that is really the overrepresentation of children of color in comparison to their representation in the general population.
Yeah.
And so I found this handy little report from July of 2017, which I find interesting because, you know, it's 2019. And so if you take a look at statewide, African-American kids, Black kids, make up about 9% of the total child population in this state. But reports to DCBS on Black kids were almost 12%.
Wow.
And substantiations were about 9%. 9.4%, services needed almost 10%.
So substantiation meaning that, like, mm-hmm. there was something to continue following up on.
Mm-hmm. And really what it means is we found something that proves you're a shitty parent.
Gotcha.
That's what that really means.
The definition of harm again.
Now, children entering out of home care, which means children who have legally been removed from the custody of their kids. Remember, 9% general population, 11.4%. coming into care. Now, when I worked in the system, the data was a lot worse. It was probably twice that much.
Okay.
What they've done is that they've pulled out biracial kids.
Mm.
And so now it is two or more races, African-American and white. So they pull African-American kids up, biracial kids out, specifically white and African-American kids, to make it seem like Black kids are not, like, we're doing a much better job. Look, the data, the numbers have gone down. These mixed kids and biracial kids, depending on who's looking at them,
right.
Y'all are Black.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And so it's really, 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 when I first started seeing the new data, I was like, y'all know y'all not shit.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is trash data, data collection. And so Hispanic, Latino, Latinx folks, 5%, are actually underrepresented in the child welfare system. But for adoptions, it's 5.1%. So exit to adoptions for brown kids is closer to their representation in the general population. And so much of what happens, and biracial kids are overrepresented too. So 2% of general population, 4.4% reports. And it really comes from people assuming that Black families in particular are more abusive and neglectful than white families. And so there were some NIH studies, there were two, back in the 90s. The first one was, yes, they are more abusive and neglectful, let's prove it. The research didn't prove it.
Because I've heard that, yeah.
And then they were like, oh, well, shit, this got to be wrong. Like, maybe our methodology was wrong, or data, like, something was wrong. And second one, so the same thing. Mm-hmm. And so you know this. The data has shown you this. But you still will come for Black families far more frequently than you will come for anybody else.
I mean, if that's not white supremacy,
like, what is? Absolutely, absolutely. And I tell you, schools are complicit in it.
I was wondering if you were going to
schools are complicit in it.
Because there are, I mean, who are the reporters? And I was thinking probably
teachers,
schools. Yeah.
During my time, so many referrals came from school folks. And so I do remember, like, right when we started trying to talk about racial disproportionality, we did these series of trainings called Undoing Racism by the People's Institute for Surviving the Beyond out of New Orleans.
Yeah.
Changed every way. Like, I was like, what in the hell? And they take you, they really, really help you understand where this all started.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the most intense work I have ever done, had ever done up to that point. And I mean, I would walk out of those sessions like, I can't stand white people.
Mm-hmm.
Y'all just trash. Mm-hmm. Y'all are the worst shit to people.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would, it was a 3-day thing, super intense. And I remember going back the second day, just mad as hell.
Yeah.
Just like, and I'm looking at everybody like, ooh, I can't, oof. And it was so hard to sit in those spaces to watch white people sort of like for everything that they said, white people come back with a different, well, what about this? Well, what about this? Well, what about this? And it was always rooted in, well, like white people's kids get taken too.
Right.
Yeah, but they don't get taken because they're white.
Yeah.
Black kids get taken because they're black. Brown kids get taken because they're brown. That's what happens. That is that, and they can say, they can reframe it any other kind of way they want.
Mm-hmm.
The data bears that out.
Yeah.
And so if you are not an all-white little child, you are at risk for removal all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Because all it takes is one well-intentioned white person to make a phone call, and they're going to show up on your doorstep.
I mean, look how many, like in the past couple of years, we've seen these stories of just nosy white people calling the police on
mm-hmm.
black families having barbecues,
mm-hmm.
or hanging out at the pool, or
mm-hmm.
sleeping in a dorm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that seems that you're talking about that, and that reminds me, these are the people who call on these families.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep, same ones. And so what is terrible for any family that gets in the CPS system, like once you're in that system, even if it's unsubstantiated, even if it doesn't meet anybody's criteria, you are still in their system.
Yeah.
And so even if one person calls on you, that stuff follows them.
I'm sure.
And it doesn't go away.
Yeah.
It does not go away. And so let's say a mom or dad or parent or a caretaker has a neglect referral substantiated. And neglect really is like you don't have access to what you need.
Oh, that's a capitalism problem.
Yeah.
But people act like that people choose not to have access to stuff.
I don't want to have food today.
Yeah.
No, not into it today.
You know, I thought about buying this bed, but I just really prefer to sleep on these floors.
I really do.
Yeah.
It's better from the back.
Right.
And so nobody chooses poverty.
Right.
Nobody's like, yeah, this poverty thing, I see it looks like it works out for folks. Let me get some of that. Nobody chooses that.
Mm-hmm.
It is a failure of every system that we have. But we will penalize people because the systems failed them.
Blame them.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Because we've been taught this where you can pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Some people don't have boots.
That's white settler colonial.
Yes,
it absolutely
that individualism without looking at anything about how society sets you up for success
right.
or keeps you down
right.
in oppression.
Right.
No, it's all always at the end of the day your fault.
Mm-hmm. But so much of it is rooted in white people are just good people inherently, like
mm-hmm,
just born
mm-hmm.
good. People of color, no.
Flawed.
Absolutely flawed.
Yeah.
And like you can't undo that.
Yeah.
Unless you shed your culture
mm-hmm.
and assimilate all the way into white culture. So you have to reject every piece of yourself
mm-hmm.
and adopt this fake identity. And maybe it'll be less likely that they'll call on you. Maybe.
White people still aren't going to see you as equal to them, even
that. They'll see you as less black or less
yeah.
white.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
As less of a threat
yeah.
and a little bit more like me.
Mm-hmm.
But you're always going to be a personal cut.
Mm-hmm.
Always. Always, always, always.
You've been listening to Decolonize Social Work, a podcast about social work, oppression, and liberation. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, and SoundCloud at Decolonize SW, and on Instagram at Decolonize Social Work.